On the Empire Podcast this week, we go face to fecking face with Colin Farrell and the man who wrote that scene in Basic Instinct, and then a whole film filled with scenes like that, the wonderfully exuberant screenwriting legend Joe Esterhaas, while we discuss the relative merits, or lack thereof, of the likes of Carrie and Saving Mr. Banks on the only movie podcast that does expect the Spanish Inquisition.
Nee.
Oh, I thought for sure Michael Palin would come in, and that's rather disappointing, actually. Anyway, on with the show. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, I'm joined by three colleagues who've temporarily shelved their objections to my terrifying bad breath, my ferocious body odor, and my proclivity for inappropriate fondling to join me here in a locked room for the next hour or so. More fool them. First up, trying to hide her distaste, is a lady whose powers of geek recall are so complete that QuizUp has banned her from downloading the app. It is, of course, Helen O'Hara. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to share a piece of information with you at this point.
What is it?
The Spanish Inquisition, by law, had to give everybody notice in writing 30 days beforehand, so everybody expected the Spanish Inquisition.
But surely they must have cut some corners and, you know.
Apparently not.
No?
No.
You know what the scariest thing about the Spanish Inquisition is? Is that it lasted for over two centuries.
Everyone have a Spanish Inquisition fact all of a sudden.
Do you know what the scariest thing about it is? Is that far more people died in the witch trials in England. And actually, the Spanish Inquisition, as such things go in terms of 16th century justice, wasn't that bad.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. They used, like, big cushions and the comfy chair.
I know, right?
Who's going to die from that?
The comfy chair! Did we all get Python tickets?
No.
Chris and
did we
I
try for Python tickets?
Probably about 600 quid on Python tickets between us.
It was a lot of money. Helen, why aren't you in QuizUp?
Because
you would rule QuizUp.
It would destroy my life. I try to avoid all games.
It doesn't, actually. It doesn't. But you only play about 10, 1200 games a day. Next up is a man who submitted his own category of film questions to QuizUp, only for the makers of the game to reject it. Apparently, for some reason, they weren't quite ready for a quiz on the thought-specular Kieslowski's White and Streitfeld's Female Perversions. It is, of course, our art house guru, Phil Dissemblian. Hello, Phil.
Hi, Chris.
That is the title of a real dissertation.
I looked it up. I wrote it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Under your pen name, Francis L. Rustuccia of Boston College.
Rustuccia.
Rustuccia.
It's pronounced.
Rustuccia, probably.
No, Rustuccia. No, I'm telling you.
Oh, you're telling me?
It's Rustuccia.
Sorry, Fran. Sorry about that.
You can call me Fran.
You good?
Apologies to dragging her into this quagmire of tenuous introductions.
Imagine someone runs up to her.
Francis, which I very much doubt.
I very
much
doubt.
Boston College.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. But what are you saying here? The thought specular.
The thought specular.
What's Streitfeld's Female Perversion?
I have no idea.
Helen?
I'm afraid I don't know either.
Any ideas?
You don't want to know.
Okay. Anyway, that's me.
It's perverse.
It's good to see you.
Thank you, man. And last but not least is a man who's already unlocked the following achievements in QuizUp's podcast editing levels. Splicer, Scissors, Schoonmaker. It is, of course, Ali Plum. Hello.
Hello.
Okay, that's it. All the introductions done. First up, let's have it at it with your questions. This is from... this is an interesting one, actually. This is from at 21st Century Cat, who asks, can this week's podcast be done in the style of Luther? Ali, what do you think?
No!
So that's a no, then. And the first genuine question is from Chris Hammond of Sheffield via email, who asks, I absolutely buzz of Holiday Road from National Lampoon's Vacation. What are your movie song guilty pleasures? And quite rightly so, That's a Good One by Lindsay Buckingham.
Well, first, darling, one should never feel guilty about pleasure.
Blimey, there's a female perversion if ever I saw one.
I don't know, I think that might be a Mae West line, but honestly, I forget. I was inspired to think of Put a Little Love in Your Heart from Scrooged.
Good one.
By this. Yeah, it's something that Ollie Richards and I have been campaigning for Lucky Voice to add to their singing lists for quite some time, but they haven't got the right version anyway. So fingers crossed for this year.
Reminds me, we need a sort of Christmas karaoke.
Yeah, we do.
Okay.
That reminds me of Marley and Marley. Whoa!
One of the things that I enjoy about working alongside Helen is that whenever things get stressful, you always break into a rendition of...
Raindrops on Roses.
Raindrops
and
Roses, exactly. So there's that.
It's also generally whenever someone says something horrendously wrong, isn't that right, Helen?
It's usually when people are about to fight. That's basically in our family, that's what you know, saying to get people to calm down and stop fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't believe I sing it often in this office because obviously we all get along very,
it's
very well
harmonious.
And it's pretty rainbowy and
it's pretty
kittens.
Harmonious.
I'm not sure whether it's like a guilty pleasure, but I've always got Every Sperm Is Sacred in my head. No more so than recently, obviously, with the Monty Python news.
They're going to sing it in the live show.
They are going to sing it in the live show. The Blackets will be back.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Hindu, Taoist, Mormon, spill theirs just anywhere.
Yeah. Marley and Marley, by the way, we should probably mention, is from the Muppet Christmas Carol, in case you don't know.
You bloody well should know.
You should know that.
I would also like to put in Batman's Bat Dance by Prince, which is a cracker. Carla DeVito's We Are Not Alone, which is the music that's playing as the Breakfast Clubbers are dancing. We are not alone.
Yeah. Generally, a lot of these tend to be from movies from the 80s, don't they?
That's certainly true.
Define guilt. I mean, really. Because every week we gather together and we debate these issues.
These burning issues.
And we keep the world spinning on its axis. But this week, I think there's a correct answer to this.
Really?
Yes, Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins.
Oh, that's a weird noise to make.
Okay. What was that?
I don't know. I just whenever I think of Kenny Loggins, I make that noise.
Female perversion.
Yeah.
Danger Zone is, for me, it's sort of where music goes when it wants to punch the air. And
that's a good one. I've got a few. I think we were talking in the office yesterday about You're the Voice by John Farnham, which is on both Hot Rod and this year Alan Partridge Alpha Papa.
Yeah,
and that's an amazing song.
If you go to Australia and you claim that is a guilty pleasure,
they will kill you.
They will kill you.
Isn't that what Wolf Creek's all about?
Yes, it's about people thinking that John Farnham is anything less than the greatest singer-songwriter in the history of music.
I think that song is compelling evidence for that, to be honest.
It's a good song.
That song has everything. It's got a bagpipe solo, for God's sake.
You introduced me to that scene in Hot Rod.
Yes.
And I will always be grateful for it because it's hilarious. I love it.
Excellent. I've got a few. I've got Bit by Bit by Stephanie Mills, which is the title track. It's not the title track, it doesn't have the same title as a movie, but it is from Fletch. And it's one of those songs that was written for the movie, so Fletch is actually referenced in the lyrics, which is exactly the same as the Michael Caine-sung theme song from Get Carter. Mm-hmm. Then we also have Mavis Staples' Christmas Vacation from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, yep, which I love. Friday Night's A Great Life for Football by Bilbo Baggins. Oh, Bilbo... Talking about, yes,
the washing up song
from The Hobbit. Well, that's what Bilbo Baggins hates. Friday Night's A Great Night for Football by Bill Medley, one half of the Righteous Brothers, at the beginning of The Last Boy Scout during the credit sequence. Has never been released commercially, but is one of the greatest songs of all time. Do check it out. He sings it to camera, surrounded
amazing.
By a bevy of female dancers while the credits dance around
this,
him. And
this
stuff.
Was
it's
from
really
the 80s
good.
Too, was it?
1991.
Yeah, but that was pretty much the 80s still.
It was pretty much the 80s. I'm sure Shane Black wrote it in the 80s, but that is awesome. And I don't think we can talk about guilty pleasures in movies without mentioning the Max Rebo Band featuring Size Noodles and Jedi Rocks, which was added to Return of the Jedi, the special edition, since 1997. It is, by every standard and criterion that you can apply to music, absolutely dreadful. It is basically kicking dirt in the face of the memory of Return of the Jedi, and yet I love it. I can't stop listening to
what
it. It's amazing. It's got the that bit where Mac, the guy goes blah, 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 blah.
I've got about four more. We've got, in my head anyway, Emperor's New Groove has an opening song called Perfect World
from Return of the Jedi.
Absolutely incredible.
Oh, a different emperor.
Another Disney film recently, Mother Knows Best from Tangled.
Great song.
It's often in my head. Also, does anybody recognise the band name Benny Jive and the Uptown Five?
No.
I know the name. Why do I know the name?
Benny Jive and the Uptown Five. I know the name as well, but...
They are teetering on the edge of becoming a different band.
Is this the quiz?
It is from High Fidelity. It is Jack Black's band as he sings... Let's get it on. And also I should point out, for The Emperor's New Groove, that is sung by Tom Jones, and he appears in the film in a cameo as a very small man who jumps out of a big cake with a massive orange afro.
Amazing. When you mentioned High Fidelity, that reminded me, I was actually watching an episode of Parks and Recreation last night, the finale of season one, with Chris Pratt going through the names of his band, which is one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Helen, you have disregarded the rules of Jinx.
Did we need to do a pinky swear or something?
I've jinxed you, and therefore you can't speak until someone says your name. But I've just said your name.
Oh.
So all's well.
Damn it. All right. That's one of those ones where we literally just sit here listing things for forever.
Theme from Sneakers.
Against all odds, take a look at me now.
Yes.
I'm just an empty...
Space?
Space or face?
Space.
I'm just... Yep.
something left here to remind me of the memory of your face.
There you go.
Yes. See ya.
There you go. That's a good one. All right. Thank you for that one, Chris Hammond. This one is from the guy who sent in about 40 questions to the podcast last week, from Albuquerque. It's Casey Bennettberg, Heisenbennett, whatever you want to call him. He says, I've seen a few great compilation videos on YouTube of the greatest movie insults and was wondering if you had any favorite insults, he spells favorite in the American way, but we'll let him off, or name-calling moments from the movies. I personally love it when Michael in Office Space finds out he's going to be fired from the company and exclaims that they are cockos.
There are some good ones. I love Office Space. It's not really an insult at anyone in the film, is it? But when he says, when somebody asks him why he's called Michael Bolton, why he doesn't change his name, and he says, I don't know why I should change my name, he's the one that sucks. Which I really love.
Awesome.
I've got a series of quotes for you here, which I'd like you to partake in as a quiz format type thing.
Okay, yeah.
So can you guess the film?
We haven't done a quiz for ages. I love this.
The insult.
Yes.
Can you guess the film? I'm going to start with some really easy ones. You punch like you take it up the ass.
Emperor's New Groove?
Close. You punch like you take it up the ass.
Three Colours White.
It's not like Escape Plan. That was you punch like a vegetarian.
Oh, that's a good one. That is a good insult. Yeah.
That's Raging Bull. I honestly thought you were going to get that straight away.
No.
You're going to get this one, Chris. You are a smelly pirate hooker. Why don't you go back to your home on Whore Island?
That would be
Anchorman.
I don't like your jerk-off name. I don't like your jerk-off behaviour. And I don't like you jerk-off. Do I make myself clear?
I don't know that one.
Come on. Me and Nathan would be getting this straight away.
Really?
Oh, Big Lebowski?
Correct, it is the Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah.
Monty, you terrible C-bomb.
With Nell.
Yes.
Ooh, second use of the C-word.
Oh, naughty.
Second?
Not last week.
Oh, okay.
I'm paraphrasing here, but I'd forgotten what your eyes remind me of, but they're exactly the same.
Piss holes in the snow, get Carter.
There we go. Mm-hmm. I fart in your general direction.
Yeah, the French taunters from Monty Python, the Holy Grail. Your father smells of elderberries.
Your mother was a hamster
and your father smelled of elderberries.
You are a sad, strange little man. And you
Toy
have
Story.
My pity.
Written by Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
That line.
Go, Joss.
It looks to me like the best part of you ran down the crack of your mama's ass and
Yay.
Ended up as a brown stain on the mattress.
Gone with the Wind. Full Metal Jacket. It was one of the two.
Correct.
One of the two classics.
It's like watching a bunch of retards trying to fuck a doorknob.
Dodgeball.
Finally, if you know me well enough, you'll get this. You bunch of sausage Nigels.
Anything snatch. With the word sausage in it.
Keep thinking, snatch.
Lockstock.
Keep thinking.
Oh. Swept Away.
Crank 2, when he walks up to the two guys with trying to put an electric voltage current belt thing around the dog.
I'd also like to add, you warthog-faced buffoon.
From
Princess Bride?
The Princess Bride.
And I'm just guessing because
I know.
It's you.
I'm pretty predictable. And this is kind of, the full line is, into the mud, scum queen.
Mama Two Brains.
The man.
That was on
my
list. Wow. I had that as well. That was a Empire Spine line back in the day.
It was, yeah.
I don't give a tuppenny fuck about your moral conundrum, you meat-headed shitsack.
Oh, that's recent, isn't
that's
it?
That's harsh.
Meat-headed shitsack.
I don't give a tuppenny fuck about your moral conundrum, you meat-headed shitsack.
Tuppenny, eh? So it is a period piece.
It is a period piece.
We're looking for something maybe Victorian, maybe Edwardian.
Knocking on that. It is.
Wait. Is it Coen Brothers?
No.
I know this
it's
one.
It's in a film that's directed by another, by the director of another film we've talked about.
What, in this podcast?
Yeah, in this.
What, is that the one fuck in Sherlock Holmes?
No, it's not the one fuck in Sherlock Holmes.
I don't give a tuppenny fuck about your moral conundrum, you meat-headed shitsack.
Everyone at home will be going, it's Gangs of New York!
Oh, of course.
Wait,
yes.
Is it Gangs of New York?
It is Gangs of New York.
Oh, amazing.
We can edit this out so we don't look as stupid as we
know. No, it's fine.
Glengarry Glen Ross for me.
Yes.
Alec Baldwin's amazing speech is basically just a 9-minute insult, which is awesome. I've got some quotes here from it. That watch costs more than your car. I made $970,000 last year. How much you make? You see, pal, that's who I am. You're nothing. Nice guy. I don't give a shit. Good father. Fuck you. Go home and play with your kids. You want to work here? Close. You think this is abuse? You think this is abuse, you cocksucker? I'm just ad-libbing now. Sorry, guys. But yeah, that's amazing. I love that whole speech. And there's a moment later on in the film where Al Pacino calls Kevin Spacey a stupid effing C-bomb. and that's a fantastic moment. We're kind of in a Christmassy vein at the moment.
Sure.
Getting into it,
you
know, looking at trees and Argos.
You're wearing your woolly jumper.
I am wearing my woolly jumper. You know, so we've mentioned National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation already, but there's an amazing moment in that where Chevy Chase, as Clark W. Griswold, has a meltdown towards the end, and it's a fantastic, not really an insult necessarily, but you should check it out if you haven't already seen it. It's a fantastic stream of consciousness rant from Chevy Chase.
In the pseudo insult thing, the one of the two good moments in Jingle All the Way, I happen to write about it so it's in my head, is when Arnie says, "Oh, poor baby," which isn't quite an insult, but I still use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I eat green berets for breakfast.
Sometimes these bits of dialogue give the actors a chance to really like just throw themselves into it. Think about drill instructor Hartman, who was, of course, played by...
Arlie Ermey.
Used to be, was an actual drill instructor, right?
Arlie Ermey.
Yeah, so that sequence, so he was just doing what he did, I think, and...
Arlie Ermey was in the army.
Ermey.
So Arlie Ermey was in the army.
Arlie Ermey, yeah.
Okay, just to clear that up, okay.
Early. And Dennis Farina, obviously, next copper.
Yeah.
One of my favourite
bits. Oh my god,
he's not just insults, but movie dialogue. In fact, his whole career was just one long insult, but just genius stuff.
Well, we talked about Farina on the podcast when he passed away, but Snatch, he's got some amazing insults in that, and obviously Midnight Run.
Yes.
He's got some amazing ones in that as well.
Doesn't he come back through US immigration and they go and he goes to the customs guy, "You've been to England. Don't go.
Don't go to England." Yeah. And he introduced himself to Mike Reed in the film with the immortal words, sit down and shut up, you bald-headed fuck."
That's as good as it gets. And this year, we should mention The World's End, because that had a great insult in it. Get back in your rocket and fuck off back to Legoland.
Why don't you get in your rocket and fuck off back to Legoland, I apologise for the use of the language. Okay, let's move on, because we don't have a lot of time left. This one is from Sarah L. Via Facebook.
Ooh.
I know, can you credit it? A Facebook question. She lives in Pittsburgh and she asks, since summer blockbusters tend to be overlooked by the Oscars, are there any that you feel deserved some sort of recognition? Pittsburgh, of course, George A. Romero's town, you know, where he made all those movies, but also where The Dark Knight Rises was filmed, which puts me in mind of The Dark Knight.
Yes, I think The Dark Knight's the obvious one here. I mean, it did get a nomination, I think, didn't it?
But won an Oscar for...
Well, obviously Heath Ledger won, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's very rare. I think, I mean, there clearly is sort of ghettoisation at the Oscars, and a so-so biopic has a much better chance of doing well than a brilliant blockbuster, and I think that's a little bit old-fashioned.
Yeah, The Dark Knight, I think, I remember whenever we were sitting up for the Oscar nominations in 2009, it would have been, and it wasn't nominated for Best Picture, and despite a lot of predictions that it would be, because it had just made $1 billion and was widely hailed as one of the best blockbusters of all time. And it didn't get a Best Picture nomination. And that was, I think, one of the reasons why they moved up to 10 nominations after that year. I think that was a large part of that. 9 or 10, whatever it is these days. And also, they obviously tend to split the American release schedule into seasons. And we're very much now in the Oscar season. And blockbusters obviously get released a lot earlier in the year. And even those that would be good enough, maybe, and it's very rare, let's be honest, to qualify for Oscars, tend to be forgotten about by the time people start voting.
That's partly true. I mean, to be honest, the last film released early in the year to do well at the Oscars was The Silence of the Lambs back in 1991. Everything else pretty much has been Oscar season, which starts in sort of September, October. But let's be honest, if you come out in September, you're kind of crippling your own chances a lot of the time. Something like Atonement was buzzed about when it first came out and completely forgotten by the time that the Oscars really came around. Got a few nominations, but no wins. I mean, I think the Oscars should be a little bit more progressive, I guess. I think they should consider animated films a bit more. I mean, we've only had two nominations for Pixar and no wins in the Best Picture category yet. They've sort of pushed them into the animation ghetto and really left it at that. And I think, you know, certainly something like Up is really as good as anything that was nominated for Best Picture that year. Well, it was nominated for Best Picture, but it still, I think, it, you know, should have had a bit more of a run because nobody expected it to win, and sure enough, it didn't. And then also, I mean, the other thing that Oscar famously overlooks are comedy performances. If you don't make people cry with sadness, you may as well forget about it. And I think that's a real, real shame, because I think Johnny Depp in The First Pirates
Yeah.
He got nominated, but again, no one expected much of it, and sure enough, nothing materialised.
Yeah, it's one of my big bugbears. Ali and I were talking about this the other day, actually, in the office, wondering when was the last great comedy performance. We were talking about Kevin Kline.
We were talking about the last time a actor won for a comedy performance, and that was Kevin Kline for A Fish Called Wanda. Well,
probably Marissa Tomei for My Cousin Vinny.
Was the actress. Best supporting actress. It was supporting for Kevin Kline as well.
Comedy is one of my big bugbears when it comes to the Oscars, and I know we've gone way off the question now, but for example, Peter Capaldi for In the Loop, I thought was amazing that year, and in my opinion definitely should have been nominated. And I saw someone the other day, and this is very interesting, you guys may not agree with this, but I saw someone the other day tweet that in an ideal world, Nick Frost for The World's End would be considered for an Oscar this year. And I'd never ever considered that. I'd never even thought about that. But I started thinking about it and went, actually, you know what? There's something in that. There's something in it, because he's really, really good in that film. And so is Simon Pegg, actually. He has a very, very difficult role. But yeah, no one ever throws her weight behind, especially a small British film like that hasn't really comes out.
But also a genre film like that. You don't get any credit for and I agree, those are both great performances. But you don't get any credit for great performances in a genre film, generally speaking.
The question is, of course, about summer blockbusters. So people at home are probably going, what about Avatar? What about Titanic? And these are all, you know, the two of the biggest films of all time. And they got a lot of Oscar love, and they were not summer blockbusters. They released bang in the middle of Oscar season, so they were very fresh in people's memories. And there definitely was a feeling that that Hollywood should reward these films, and Return of the King as well. There was a sense that Hollywood should reward themselves almost for doing this incredible job and reaching these many people. What's interesting is that Return of the King, Titanic, Avatar were all rewarded. Something like The Avengers, the third biggest film of all time, was not.
No.
Recognised by the Oscars in any way. I think maybe it got a couple of effects nods. I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, interesting.
It's a shame. I mean, I think maybe not for the Avengers, because that was very much an ensemble piece, but Robert Downey Jr. for Iron Man, I think, is a really, really good performance. It's just not an Oscar-y kind of a performance, and stuff like that's always going to get overlooked. Hey-ho.
We could be here all day.
Best comedy for us. Last best picture comedy. Anybody remember?
Was it Marty?
Annie Hall.
1977.
I know.
Does it make you sad? I mean, it makes me sad. I mean, obviously, that this brings back to the age-old conversation of Star Wars and in that year as well. But it is, you know, can't work it out in my head, but a long time ago.
Fantastic. Sorry, Sarah L., for going so far off the beaten track with that question. Thank you all for your questions. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so via the usual channels. We're on Twitter as @EmperorMagazine. Use the hashtag EmperorPodcast, otherwise we probably won't see your question. We're on Facebook, Empire Magazine, and you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Time now for our first interview. Joe Esterhaus is one of the most colourful figures in screenwriting, a larger-than-life rock and roll bear of a man, most famous for writing the lurid, sexy likes of Jagged Edge, Basic Instinct, and, of course, Showgirls. While off-screen, his wildlife was very notorious and is the basis of several compelling books by Esterhaus, including Hollywood Animal. You should check it out. It is fantastic. He's a changed man these days, though, and when he was in town recently for an appearance at the London Screenwriters Festival, he popped into the pod booth to talk to myself and Nick Desemlian. Enjoy.
So in terms of rules, I mean, you wrote a book a few years ago, which is amazing, The Devil's Guide to Hollywood.
Yes.
Which is essentially a screenwriting guide for people who aren't Robert McKee enthusiasts.
Yes, thank you.
Which is great. So have you ever had people read that book? Because I thought it was fantastic.
Yes.
And come up to you and go, I've written a script based on the principles you outlined in this book.
Right.
Has that happened to you?
I've had something better than that. I was in our local church one day, and this guy comes shambling in. I'm there with my family on a Sunday morning, and this guy shambles in, and everyone else is sitting down and praying, essentially, and the guy shambles in and he goes, Joel. I looked up and I said, yeah. He said, I wrote my script. And I said, dude, we're in church, we're praying, all right? He said, but I read your book, and I wrote my script. I said, well, which of my books did you read? He said, The Devil's Guide. I said, wrong book, I can't look at your script now, sorry. And they escorted him out, you know, so anything can happen. No, that's why I said, we'll see what happens. No, I enjoy doing these things. I like talking to young screenwriters, because I think a lot of them get some really bad information and bad advice from people like McKee, who's written one script that's been made on television. And there are others, legendary screenwriters, who essentially teach young screenwriters to be cowed and never to speak up and do stuff like pretend you're taking notes for a producer when you're not hardly listening. And there's another one who said that the screenwriters are here to work out the director's vision. Mm. Well, I reject that. I think that's bad and marginalizing advice, because if you write your own scripts as spec scripts and it comes from your own heart and soul, you are the one initiating that, and the vision is yours. So I think you have a responsibility, at least a good option, to fight the good fight and not allow people to change your script as they say in Hollywood, to piss in it, to keep it as clean as possible in terms of the original vision. Yeah. I realize that that not a lot of people give screenwriters that advice, but through the course of making 17 films, and doing it for almost 40 years, I think that's the only way to go if you're going to continue to be able to look yourself in the mirror on your next one and to really put your heart and soul into it. Mm. Because people will try to beat that out of you. And also in the process of that, they can turn what you've written into a really bad movie. I wrote Basic Instinct with that ambiguous ending and got into a gigantic fight with the director, Paul Verhoeven, whom I respect, and Michael Douglas, whom I don't. About the ending of that movie, and Michael won it. Michael kept saying that Sharon one-ups him at every turn, and that the movie should end with Michael shooting her, killing her. Well, that's TV dribble. So I don't want to do that.
That's ego.
And I did go a little apeshit, and then ultimately Paul did bring another writer in, but he canned him and wound up shooting my original first draft version. Thank God.
Were you on set for the whole of Basic Instinct?
I don't like being on set. I got into big trouble once on the set of Betrayed, which were in Calgary. It was a long day, and then I came to my hotel room at like 1:30 in the morning, and there was a gaffer there who worked the crew and all of that stuff, and by that time I'd been listening to a days full of different suggestions on the piece, because we were right in the middle of shooting, and he said, Joe, and I said, yeah, he said, I'm blah blah blah, and I've been waiting for you because I have a really great idea for the third act. Okay, and I just picked him up by his lapels and bounced him off a wall and said, good evening. you got to fight for what you believe. I said, no. Now, I grant you that there are more civil ways of doing that. And I really like being nice to people. I really do. I have a very loving family. And I like to live my life in a way that maintains the dignity of the people that I'm dealing with or working with, and I certainly agree that bouncing someone off a wall by their lapels is not a nice thing to do, and I apologize profusely, and I think my apology was accepted.
Okay. That didn't happen with Michael Douglas.
he's an actor, they don't matter. I'm teasing. It was a big fight, and I just felt that it was the wrong advice for the movie, and it would have turned the movie into something else. And I've heard from so many people through the years about that ambiguous ending and that ice pick at the end, that I think it was a good call. The man who headed Carol Go at the time, Mario Casar, and Paul were adamant that they not focus group that ending with the ice pick, because they were certain that the ambiguity was going to put people back, and that they would have trouble with financiers if they did it. And I applaud the courage of both of them for not allowing the focus groups, because I think it would have made a difference.
But I'm guessing you have seen scenes that you've written executed in a way that you wouldn't have done it. I remember Sliver. There's a kind of the notorious bathtub scene which got a lot of kind of ridicule at the time.
Yes,
were you unhappy with how that was done?
You should have seen some of the outtakes. The outtakes are real collector's items. So Philip Noyce described one of those outtakes with Billy Baldwin and Sharon Stone in a love scene as rutting, RUTTING. They were rutting, Philip said. So the outtakes are great. Yeah, of course, it happens. It is a collaborative process. Philip opted to film that the way he did. I'm not a director. I've never wanted to be a director. I don't have the talent to be a director. And Philip is a world-renowned director. I looked at the rough cuts and then I gave him my opinion. But ultimately, all I can do is be very strong in my opinion and try to change his mind. I did that, and Philip opted to go with that scene the way he did. The screenwriter's power that way, let's be honest, is really limited. The biggest power you have, and maybe the only real power that counts in that sense, is to be a colossal pain in the ass when you see something that's wrong, you know, and to be willing to go to the wall. And I'm Hungarian born, and I know how to be a colossal pain in the ass. And so I do that sometimes. But past that, you can't do a whole lot, you know.
Do you watch a lot of movies these days? And what's impressed you?
I liked some things recently. I liked Captain Phillips. You know, I think the guy Greengrass is a very talented guy. I liked Rush. I myself was disappointed in Gravity, but a lot of people around me really liked the movie. So occasionally there's something out there, but it's not often.
What disappointed you about Gravity? Because a lot of people have obviously praised the effects and praised the technique behind it, but I think some people have problems with the script and the dialogue. I think there's been a slight growing backlash in the States.
Yeah, I felt that as well. Or, you know, I didn't think it was... It was hyped to me, at least, as being really visually dazzling. I didn't find it visually dazzling. I thought he played the same beats over again visually. We saw the things coming at us, and then they went away, and they ducked them and all of that. You know, but it didn't grab... it didn't grab my heart. You know, and I didn't really get into it. I thought the final 15 minutes of Captain Phillips with what Tom Hanks did, you know, was a true revelation. I had no idea Tom Hanks could act like that, you know. And if he wins an Oscar, that's what's going to win it.
Yeah, know? The last scene, I think.
It grabbed me. The last of that sequence, it grabbed me and almost made me cry, you know, and I never expected it came out of nowhere.
So you're talking about the movies these days that are almost cartoons, and I guess you're talking about comic book movies and just the big blockbusters. Was that ever your forte? Were you ever comfortable when you were asked to... Were you ever asked to do script doctoring work on projects like that?
No, I'm trying to think if I ever did any script doctor work at all. I came in, I did a rewrite of Flashdance, which was written originally by Tom Hedley, and it was an overwhelming big rewrite. I didn't even like to do those very much. But I never did any doctor work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I liked to play nurse when I was a kid, but I never did any doctor work.
Talking of Flashdance, weirdly, Brian De Palma and David Cronenberg were both attached to that project at certain points.
Boy, I never heard that. Now there were two lives to that movie. Linda Obst, Peter Guber, and John Peters worked on one version, and with Tom Hedley's script. Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer took it over. I never even saw Peters or Guber anywhere around the set, nor Linda Obst, and I suspect that. Those guys being attached must have come in the first reign with Guber and Peters, because I never heard it.
Okay.
What's interesting about the movie is the studio had so little hope in the movie that they sold off 30% of their potential profit before it came out. It was a completely unexpected hit that played forever, you know, and made a terrific amount of money. But the LA Times did a big article about the film and listed all the various people that had taken part, Tom Hedley, me, the different producers, Linda Obst, and all that. And they put all these accounts together. And all of us said, no, it was a hit because of me. I made it a hit, right? Every eight of them, it was the greatest Rashomon in Hollywood history, right? I include myself. I felt like a complete asshole after I read it. You know.
You mentioned Don Simpson. I'm a huge fan of Don Simpson's stories.
Yes.
My favorite might be the one of him going back to his high school reunion. And
yeah, it's like one of my favorite stories.
So what is your best Don Simpson story?
Well, Don and I were really good friends, and we became great friends on Flashdance. And continued to be good friends after that. And I have two stories that I think are really revealing of Don. I'd broken up with my first wife, and I was with Naomi in Hawaii, and we were tabloid fodder, the National Enquirer, and all this stuff. So we were flying back from Hawaii, where we were hiding from the world, And suddenly, in the mid-flight, this gnome-like little person comes up, and I admit that I'd had a significant amount to drink, and I wasn't in the best shape and all that, you know. So this little person comes up, and he sticks this imaginary microphone in my face, and he goes, "Mr. Esteras, Jimmy Lennon from the National Enquirer, are you here with your girlfriend?" And I look back, and it's Simpson. And I said, "Simpson, what are you doing here?" He said, "Well, I'm in coach, you son of a bitch, but you're in first class, right?" So the other story was that I loved with Don is he came from a very strict Christian missionary background. He grew up in Alaska. His parents were missionaries. He had this odd relationship with his parents for obvious reasons, considering who Don was and what he'd done with his life and stuff. And he asked me over to his house, and he had this beautiful house near the Bel Air Hotel. No longer in coach, certainly. You know, so and he's taking me around the house, and there's some photographs that are in silver frames. And I look closely, and it's a little Don with people in missionary clothing, they put their arms around him. And I said, "You didn't want to show me these." He said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, they're your parents, aren't they?" And he looked at me and stopped and said, "For a moment there, I forgot who I was dealing with, Esteras." He was a grand character. He was smart as a whip. I enjoyed every minute of my time with him, and I miss him to this day.
Have you ever considered shocking everyone and doing an animated film, writing an animated film or a film about
a puppy? Well, I did something that I thought would shock everyone. I did a movie about Our Lady of Guadalupe, who was a Catholic symbol for much of the world, especially the Latino world. And The New Yorker, when they announced that I was writing this piece, The New Yorker's headline was, "Esteras takes on 475-year-old virgin." Which I thought may have been an homage. I don't know. You know, considering my age, it may have been an homage. You know.
So is there a pile of unproduced scripts?
Yeah, there's some. Through the years, I did one, for example, on Otis Redding called Blaze of Glory. And I happened to be accidentally the last journalist to interview Otis in Cleveland at a place called Leo's Casino before his plane crashed. And I always loved his music and had a fondness for him. And I did this piece that I liked a lot that hasn't been made, that wound up getting into a huge controversy with two of the real life characters depicted in the piece. There's the Maccabees, of course, which I love, and I think is one of my favorite things that I've written, which is trapped in Mel Gibson land for legal reasons, you know, because he came to me with the idea and said, "Let's do this." I can't either take it away or do another piece on the Maccabees without having Mel use his Midas-like fortune to harass me in court and my children for the next 50 years.
Is that indefinite?
It seems to be, unless, and I mean, it's a tough word to use in films, because I wrote the movie Telling Lies in America. I wrote 10 years as Magic Man before it was made and sold, right? So things can come out of the walls. In this particular case, my lawyer, who's very good and very smart and certainly looking at the legal danger, has said to me, if he tries to get you, he'll have to come through me. At the same time, she said, to take it away, either yourself or to write another one on the same subject matter, considering the animosity and the true hatred that seems to be in the bottom of his soul, you're going to be in a lot of trouble, so please don't do that. Yeah. And I think there are like two or three others maybe that I've done through the years.
So it seems to me, I mean, not to get too much into the Mel Gibson thing, because you've always wrote a book,
yes, of course,
a book on that, which is on the Kindle store. It seems to me that that relationship is irreparable, that there's no way back.
Well, look, I mean, I will say what I've said before publicly in different places, and that is that Mel needs help. There is some core of violent hatred in his heart that someone will have to try to deal with before there is a tragedy and somebody gets hurt, because it's that kind of overwhelming threat of violence that's there. So I don't see any possibility of doing that. And mind you, I'm speaking about Hollywood, where, you know, anything and everything can be solved or schmoozed away or pretend it's not there. But in this particular case, I don't think so.
Well, there's so much sycophancy towards stars in that town.
Yes.
You seem like somebody who's not afraid to just tell anyone to their face what you think.
Dude, I'm a Hungarian refugee from the west side of Cleveland, and when I went to school as a kid, there was this place called Nick's Diner down the street where older guys in leather jackets hung out. And it was in, I either had to somehow negotiate my way through or get the shit beat out of me. So, you know, that was a great lesson for Hollywood, I think. I mean, a formidable lesson.
Well, it's interesting, for example, I mean, you had a... I don't know whether you personally had a clash with Sly Stallone on Fist, but I know, for example, he didn't want to die in that movie, which, given that it was basically the Jimmy Hoffa story, might have been an interesting twist. But then, obviously, you worked with him on Burn Hollywood Burn.
Yeah, so. And Burn Hollywood Burn, and before then, Sly was desperate that I come in and do a rewrite on Staying Alive, the movie he did with Travolta. Oh. And I'll never forget, we had this meeting in this trailer, you know, and I said, John was there. I said, Sly, come on, man, you screwed me on Fist. You're going to do it with the tree trunk now and Staying Alive? Is that the game? You know, and he really laughed. Yes, he died. And in my mind, Sly made a mistake. He admitted to me afterwards that it was a mistake. He apologized. He said, and in my experience with him ever since then and in different things, is that he's a terrific stand-up guy. Mm. You know, we all make mistakes, and we're all young, and in that particular situation, he was in a very overwhelmingly heady place. He had become the biggest star in the world. He suddenly made Brinks trucks filled with money. His personal life was in shambles, and he lost his balance, and as he said, and I think he's right, he did.
I just wanted to ask about Basic Instinct and Showgirls. Obviously, they both got sequels, which were not particularly good. The Basic Instinct one is set here in London. Did you have ideas for what you would have done?
The Basic sequel, I saw that, and then the Basic sequel, what I would have done is start from scratch. I thought it was a terrible story. And every beat of it would try to somehow hang on to the coattails of the one before it, right? And I don't mean this pejoratively, I wouldn't have made it with Sharon, the sequel. I wouldn't have made it. I think Sharon could have had a part in it, but I would not have made it with Sharon as the lead. I haven't seen the Showgirls play that you're talking about, that evidently they mounted here.
There's films as well. I think two sort of direct-to-DVD sequels as well, I believe.
Mm. Oh, I mean, you mean the same movie with the DVDs, with the director's cut?
No, different movies. Follow-ups.
I wasn't aware of that.
Sorry to bring it to you.
No, I wasn't aware of that. That sounds like news that my lawyer might be very interested in. So we'll make her day.
We'll Google this afterwards.
Are they English?
No, American.
So, but Joe, we have to let you go in a second here, but we can't let you go. I know you probably Basic Instinct is something that's brought up again and again and again, but the interrogation scene in Basic Instinct is a Rashomon-type situation, because we have Sharon Stone's version, Paul Verhoeven's version, and your version. What's the truth? What's the truth behind the sequence?
Well, my version is that the in the interrogation scene itself, in the script, I don't have that famous flash where we had in the previous scene before he brings her downtown, and he's watching her. We see her naked in that scene, and we see that she's not wearing any underwear. Mm. Right now, is Sharon, what's Sharon's take exactly? That it never happened. Is that what her take?
She was tricked.
Boy, Sharon's not a Vestal Virgin either. I don't think it's easy to trick her, you know. Knowing Paul, you know, I would think that that's not how he did it. I think he would say, Sharon, we do this now, okay? You know, I am the director, you not. So we do right now. You take them all off right away. Okay, let's go. And that sounds much more like Paul Verhoeven to me than anything else.
One day we'll get all three of you in the room together. We'll hash it out.
I would welcome that. It might be really interesting. That we should film, and probably that should be the real sequel. We'll see
Wayne Knight watching.
Yeah.
Precisely. Joe, it has been an absolute pleasure. Enjoy London while you're here.
No, it's been a great pleasure with you guys. To hear fun. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Any plans? You going to do some touristy stuff?
Well, I'm here with Naomi and my 16-year-old son John, and they have not been here in London. And John is a reader, and he likes fantasy literature a lot. So he's talking about places like the Tower of London and whatever else like that we can do. I am at, since they will have been at at my mercy for 2 days with this round of stuff, and they've elected to come, then they will tell me what to do in the, after 2 days after that.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you have a great time, Joe Esterhaus. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
That man has the best voice I have ever heard in this booth. A rumbling growl. It's just amazing. I'm very, very envious of that voice.
We need to get Blessed in here one day.
Movie news time. What have you got?
Well, I have a brief note about release dates before we do anything else.
Oh, I love release dates.
Steady, Chris.
I love release dates.
I know you do.
You know I love release dates.
I know you do. Oh. Okay, so World of Warcraft, a.k.a. Warcraft, the Duncan Jones adaptation of the crazy video game.
Told ya!
Yeah, you did. Everybody did. You're completely right. When its predicted release date was December 18th, 2015, a certain Star Wars Episode 7 landed on the same release date, and we all said...
Star Wars: Episode 7.
Okay, let me start that again. A certain Star Wars Episode 7 landed on the same date. Now, director Duncan Jones was initially bullish, said bring it on, but has decided that, you know, discretion is the better part of valor and has moved to March of 2016 instead. Quite frankly, I think it's a wise decision on his part. Gives him more time to get it perfectly right and avoids being overshadowed by another big sci-fi movie the same day.
Well, I bet you that the Yoda Solo spin-off movie will land on that same date now. And he has to keep pushing it back every 3 months and then another Star Wars movie comes along.
Oh, I think he'll be okay.
And
there were a few other moves at the same time. The Seventh Son, which was originally due out this autumn. Like, in fact, should be out now.
Your set visit report on that movie ran in Empire, I think it was 1993.
I think it was. That was due to be out now-ish. It's actually now out on February 6th, 2015. So add another. That's a fantasy film starring Jeff Bridges as a sorcerer who takes Ben Barnes as his apprentice to fight the evil witch Julianne Moore. Not her in real life, her character, an evil witch. Then we have Michael Mann's cyber thriller on January 16th, 2015, another big film for that year, and Jennifer Lopez's low-budget thriller The Boy Next Door on January 23rd. The Mummy, meanwhile, the reboot of The Mummy will be April 2015, so look out for that one.
Indeed. Thank you, Helen. For release date porn.
If you know Stanley Kubrick's life and legacy, the film that he promised was going to be his greatest ever never got made, which was Napoleon. It was kiboshed by the release of the Battle of Waterloo movie, Waterloo, and went into turnaround. Interestingly, Steven Spielberg had stepped up to produce a sort of a resurrection of the project, and it's going to be on HBO as a miniseries. Baz Luhrmann is the man that has been fingered for the role. So contain your excitement. Don't put that expression on your face, Chris. I didn't mean it that way.
Probably not the best choice of words.
I didn't mean it. He's not...
Thank you for not finishing that sentence, Phil.
Yeah. Fingered for the role. Come on. It's like being fingered for the crime. Okay. Baz Luhrmann is the man that has been selected to potentially to put this thing together, this beast of an HBO miniseries. Now, there's so much archive material that Kubrick collected. He had these index cards and he got so method into this project. And this is a true story, that on the set of A Clockwork Orange, he started eating like Napoleon. He would have his pudding first and work backwards, which is like Napoleon and every seven-year-old in the world. And I don't know if Baz Luhrmann's going to be doing that or what he's going to be doing with it, but it's a strange coalescence of material and director, I would say.
Mm.
Unless John Leguizamo plays like Marshall Ney or Josephine.
Yeah. Well, do we know what era Napoleon we're talking about here? Is this the young up-and-comer during the French Revolution, or is this the Empereur?
Or,
you know,
or the Dynamite era?
10 years later.
Or Bill and Ted's Napoleon. Waterloo Water Slides. It's going to be, if it's anything like the Kubrick version, it will be more of the backstory. It was going to be a candlelit kind of origin story,
okay,
a little bit. And then it was going to roll forward and it was going to get to the Battle of Waterloo. He had 50,000 extras lined up to do this thing,
wow,
which is about 20,000 more than turned up on the actual battle.
Did he tell them to stand down, or are they still awaiting it?
They're still in Belgium. Some of them are getting old. So Baz has it's a big job, and it's complicated by the fact that, like Kubrick, there's another Napoleon out there. Da, da, da. Rupert Sanders has got one going on for Warner Brothers, and it's going to be interesting to see what that means. But this is HBO, so you know, anything's possible.
I'm really excited. This is a great opportunity for short actors to get a really plum role,
or tall actors in very big holes.
that's also a possibility, I guess, yeah.
I wonder who Baz Luhrmann's going to finger for those roles.
I think they should do what Charlie Chaplin originally had planned when he became obsessed with Napoleon and started dressing up as Napoleon and walking around as Napoleon. He eventually came up with a script, which, of course, wasn't made, in the talkie era. And unfortunately, Charlie Chaplin, comedy god, the jokes weren't so hot when it came to actually saying them out loud, and it didn't get made. But his idea was that he's imprisoned in Elba, but there's a replacement that comes along, a looky-likey comes along and gets swapped out for Napoleon. Napoleon escapes and becomes a painter, like a kind of a street-side painter in Paris. The looky-likey dies as Napoleon, and then the real Napoleon watches his funeral from, you know, outside Montmartre and goes, and some
apologies to all French
terrible
listeners.
Jokes come out. So yeah, do look that up. It's an interesting story to what Charlie Chaplin wanted to do there.
Fun fact, Napoleon's actually buried in a tomb below ground level. So if you stand on the floor in the Invalides and look at the tomb, you have to bow.
Is that right?
And that was mandated in
so
his will.
Would he have been one of the zombies in World War Z if they got to the catacombs?
He's actually buried inside 12 coffins. It's an ancient Egyptian funeral rite.
Not.
So I think even if he were zombified, he would have trouble getting out of them all. The outer one is enormous and made of marble. So I think that would probably cause some problems. Mm. This all reminds me, whatever happened to that film that they were going to make about Napoleon on St. Helena with, I think, Scarlett Johansson as the girl who looked after him in prison? Do you remember that was cast a few years ago and just never quite materialised?
Clearly never happened.
I guess not. Oh well.
Biff.
We wish Baz all the best. It must be difficult to direct while being fingered.
My news story is very, very quick. Sony, who of course own the rights to Spider-Man, and as far as I'm aware, no other Marvel properties are keen to keep the Spidey gravy train going. So Amazing Spider-Man 2 is coming out next year, but they want to do other Spider-Man universe properties. They want to take other Spider-Man properties and turn them into films. So people are suggesting Venom, and people are suggesting, obviously, Aunt May, the early years. Chris is obviously not taking the joke well and looks genuinely distraught.
I know you're joking, but that's just the worst idea in the history of bad ideas.
The other news is that J.R.R. Tolkien will be getting a biopic, not with Warners or with the Peter Jackson team, but in fact with Fox Searchlight. So they are looking to tell the story of his experiences both at university and in the Great War, and obviously the process of writing both The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. People are suggesting titles, Look Who's Talking, or Tolkien is one, which somebody, I've got to credit him because it was their joke on the forum, Funkel, F-U-N-K-E-L. Thank you for suggesting Look Who's Talking.
I've got two news stories. That's a rarity.
Wow.
Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
It's not, it's the 29th. But a freshly rebooted and remasked and remacheted Friday the 13th will be out on, get this, Friday the 13th of
what?
March 2015. Yes, it's landed just a week after Warcraft, is that right? No, 16. Oh, my release date born. It's going to come out in 2015. It's Jason Voorhees will go toe-to-toe with all those movies coming out in 2015. Which is bold and brave, given that the last one was rubbish and didn't do that well. I would just say, I know you guys aren't that big horror fans compared, but I would say that they should really reboot this one and do it with Pamela Voorhees, his mother, and not Jason Voorhees.
Maybe they will.
Maybe they will. If you're listening to me, people who are doing that. And also, I guess this is horror-related. They've been trying to make a movie of The Stand, Stephen King's magnum opus, for years, although The Dark Tower is really his magnum opus. But this massive, fantastic, apocalyptic novel, if you haven't read it, do check it out. And Paul Greengrass is reportedly in talks to direct that, for Warner Brothers.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, that's...
But they can't call it
The Stand.
I don't
think it'll happen, but I think it would be amazing.
We have bigger, 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 bigger news than all of that, of course.
Which is?
The Empire magazine.
Hooray!
Is coming to you if you go and buy it from newsagents or other shops that sell it.
Or you may have already bought it, or it may have already winged its way to you if you're a subscriber.
Came out yesterday. So Transformers Age of Extinction is on the cover. Inside we have the full report from the Detroit and Hong Kong sets. of the film, so that's worth looking out for. You can hear from the new cast members there, none of this Shia LaBeouf nonsense. We also have a massive Oscar report, which forms the kind of the backbone of the rest of the issue. So if you're worried that, you know, Transformers is too explodey for you, rest assured there's some serious performance porn in there as well.
There's acting explosions.
There's some. That sounds wrong, but yes, let's go with that. So we've got 12 Years a Slave, we've got Gravity, Labor Day, The Wolf of Wall Street, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, The Book Thief, All is Lost, Spike Jonze's Her, the Coen brothers talking about Inside Llewyn Davis, and much, much more. That's an absolutely fantastic section, as well as talking to the sort of the likely actor nominees, people like Kate Blanchett, Bruce Dern, etc. And in case that's a bit too serious, but you still don't want explodey, then we have the cast of Anchorman talking about their comedy.
Yes, we do. I flew to Los Angeles when I wasn't hosting it the other week.
Was that on the wings of love, Chris?
No, it was on an airplane, Helen.
Oh, okay.
Are you sure it wasn't on a giant glittery rainbow?
No, guys, you can't travel from London to LA on a wings of love or a giant glittery rainbow. It's just not feasible. I flew British Airways, obviously. Hello.
To Pleasure Town.
No, to Los Angeles. Have you not been listening to a word I said? Anyway, so I sat down with Will Ferrell, Steve Carell, Dave Koechner, and Paul Rudd for a... it's funny, but also they're quite reflective as comedians when they're not in Anchorman character, and it's a very interesting kind of history of their relationship together and Anchorman, and a little bit of Anchorman 2 there as well. Also, the Slate section this month is our review of the year. It's got lots of infographics, lots of fun stuff in there, lots of funny little factoids, and it has all of Team Empire's top tens of the year, provisional top tens, of course, because we hadn't seen certain movies before we made our top 10 choices, but do go and check those out, and then you can yell and scream at us and call us idiots. And in the On Location section, we have a world exclusive set report from the set of Darren Aronofsky's Noah with Russell Crowe and Darren Aronofsky. We also have Blackwood and Hyena and a whole host of other cracking set visits in there as well. So there you go, that's the movie news. Empire Magazine is available in print and on the iPad, £3.99 from all good and evil news agents. Go and pick it up now, please. Second interview time now. From his explosive debut in Tigerland, Colin Farrell has been one of the most charismatic actors around, working with a who's who of great directors: Spielberg, Stone, Mann, Malick, Allen, Gilliam, Weir, then Wiseman. The Irish actor can be seen this week in John Lee Hancock's Saving Mr. Banks as the alcoholic father of Emma Thompson's P.L. Travers. And when he was in town this week, we sent Helen, and in a change to our advertised lineup from last week's podcast, Phil, to talk to him, because I was going to talk to him as well, but we realised that three Irish people in the room would need subtitles, and subtitles don't work in podcasts, isn't that right, Phil?
I'm Irish.
You're not Irish. You're Romanian.
I'm a bit Irish.
Romani-English.
Romanglish.
Romanglish. Here's the Colin Farrell interview. Enjoy it.
I met her, I interviewed her for that, and I asked her if she thought that she'd be okay, which I think is a naive question in retrospect. Her character might find some way back.
Oh, are you okay? Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, Kate was like,
well, it is Blanche DuBois, isn't it? I mean, that's.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is Streetcar, even down to the pull-out bed in.
Yeah, they kind of like slightly distanced themselves from that a little bit.
You know, the whole.
A tiny bit.
Did they really?
A little bit, yeah. They were like, surprised. Yeah, it's got that, but it's not. It's supposed
her
to be.
Her ex is Polish.
Yeah, well, I hadn't thought of that. That's right, yeah.
You know, the one really sweet sister and the other sister who talks of this grand life of opulence and
yeah. Yeah. You're probably right.
Completely. And then the guy, Carl Malden, is. Carl Malden is Peter.
You should have done the interview, Colin.
I just read that on the internet. No,
Have you played Stanley Kowalski?
No, I did. I played Tom in Last Menagerie, only in drama school. Last Menagerie is one of my favorite plays. But the Streetcar is a tricky one.
Yeah.
Right, we should probably officially start. So, welcome to the Empire Podcast, Colin Farrell. So, we're here, I guess, to talk about Saving Mr. Banks or whatever else occurs to us, really, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, how did you get involved in this in the first place? Just start with the obvious question.
I got sent an email by my agent and script to follow and a little note saying that there was a bit of a hurry on it. It was all happening very fast, and I read it, and then I emailed them at 2 o'clock in the morning, just making sure it was an offer, because I wanted to contain myself. I was very excited about it. It was one of the most, if not the most, moving and engaging, emotionally engaging script that I've read. I had read scripts that were more kind of intellectually challenging or obscure, but this felt like old fashioned filmmaking. It felt almost conventional, and I don't mean that as a bad thing. I mean, to tell a story in a conventional way and have it as engaging as Kelly Marcel's script is an impressive feat. So I just wanted to be part of it, yeah.
I just wondered, just to jump in, what that first email kind of looks like. And the agent calls, he's like, Colin, got this great script.
Dear Colin, like, he's known me 15 years and he's so jaded and so impersonal. It's still, dear Colin. And it ends with, look forward to your thoughts. So seriously, 15 years. Well, that's fine. And it was just, this is a script that Disney are producing with John Lee Hancock, set to direct. And please take a look at the role of, this is moving fairly fast, so I suggest you get on as soon as you can. Looking forward to your thoughts, Josh Lieberman.
Is he one of those people who has like his last line in the signature? So looking forward to hear your thoughts.
They're not even pretending.
No
kisses.
They're
not even pretending that there's any personal involvement in most of the correspondence. Yeah.
You play obviously a real life person in Travis Goff, and you've played real life people before, obviously. And I was thinking about John Smith in The New World, and you did an enormous amount of research about John Smith, and you read a lot of books. And what was the kind of greatest extreme you went to find out about this man?
Nada, nothing. I mean, it was very hard to. There's scant information out there regarding Robert Travis Goff and his life, just his date of birth and when he died, and bits and pieces like he had claimed to have spent some time in Ireland, some summers in Ireland, but in fact he was born in London and he travelled straight from there. I can't even say for a fact that he wasn't in Ireland, but he certainly didn't have the amount of Irish influence based on his experiences in his life as he said he did, I don't believe. But he was in love with, he was in love with Celtic mythology, and he was a great man for getting drunk and singing limericks, and was a huge fan of W.B. Yeats' poetry, and that was literally it. I think it was the most constructed of the characters in the film by way of Kelly Marcel's imagination than all the other characters. I mean, Don DeGrady and the Sherman brothers and obviously Walt Disney and P.L. Travers, there was quite a bit of information on, but Travers Goff, she kind of worked backwards from where P.L. Travers ended up and the few little facts she could find about her father, and then worked backwards and dramatised it. So I just went, I think more than any of the other actors, I just went off the page because I had no choice.
Wow. Gotcha.
It sounds like what you've described sounds like an Irish person anyway. You know, if those were his interests, if those were what he liked and was into, that's like the stereotypical vision.
Well, unfortunately,
of Ireland,
I don't know anyone that's into Celtic mythology, or none of my mates could even spell Yeats. I mean, you know, and certainly wouldn't be able to quote any of his poetry. So, you know, but we like the Brits like to have a drink, and sometimes it can get out of hand. Yeah. And he's somebody that was. He died an early death. He died when P.L. Travers was not P.L. Travers, when she was Helen Goff, about 7 years of age. Yeah. I think I don't even know what exactly it was hard to, whether it was from, I think it was a lot of things compounded by alcoholism.
A little bit like, not to talk about The New World here too much, but a little bit like The New World, it's kind of a film of two halves in a sense, not chronologically, but there's two stories run parallel.
Yes.
And I guess you don't really share any screen time with Emma Thompson or Tom Hanks.
No.
And aside from reading the script, I wonder do you know what's happening over there? And when you see the film, you're like, oh, all right.
Yeah,
okay,
no, it was cool,
man.
It was really cool. Look, the best part, the most rewarding part for me of seeing any of the films that I've done are the moments that I'm not in. and the moments, take that whatever way you want it. But even among other things, but by virtue of me not being privy to how they were framed and how they were shot and the music therein. So when I saw the whole film, I was really caught up in it. Not so much my stuff, of course, and I'm a distraction to myself, but for the rest of the story, which is 65 or 70% of the story, I was so caught up in it. Because they shot our stuff in chronological order at the start of the film. So they blocked out 2.5 weeks at the beginning of the shoot, and we went up to a ranch called Big Sky Ranch, about an hour and a half's drive north of Los Angeles, and found this scorched earth plot of land, and they built this beautiful period wooden house on top of this bluff, and we had a horse and 6 chickens and me and Ruth Wilson and 3 kids, and it was a dream. It really felt like shooting this complete movie and a completely entirely different film from the one that came later.
A bit Ballykiss Angel again.
Razor the White Horse. Cutthroat Razor.
What do you remember the first Disney film you saw as a kid? Because I know that you were very...
Yeah, The Jungle Book. The Jungle Book.
Where was that?
I never saw Mary Poppins when I was a kid. I was too busy getting off on Willy Wonka. That sounds weird. You know what I mean, though. I was more of a Willy Wonka man than I was a Mary Poppins.
Getting sweaty
girl.
With the Oompa Loompas.
A bit like that, yeah. More into Everlasting Gobstoppers and fizzy lifting drinks than spoonfuls of sugar.
Yeah. Why have spoonfuls when you can have vats?
Indeed, that's what I say. At least that's what the minibar thought I said last night at 5 a.m. when I woke up and emptied it. But yeah, the Jungle Book was the first one. And I grew up watching all Disney's cartoons, but live action, not so much.
What was the first animation that you showed your kids? What's the most watched in the Farrell?
The most watched, Henry for the longest time was into Ice Age for the longest time. And James was into Mamma Mia. I know that's not an animated film.
Kind of is.
It's very animated.
It's quite animated. You're right. It is quite animated. But I'll go with those two.
I have a slightly left field question, which is that P.O. Travers, Emma Thompson's character, has a real problem with a lot of the issues, a lot of the things that Walt Disney wants to bring to this story. But animated penguins are a real bugbear. And I wondered if you have any things that really bug you in movies. Because this is something we talk about quite a lot.
Right.
People never saying goodbye at the end of any phone call. For instance.
Okay. That kind of thing. I'm just going to stay on the phone call thing. When somebody hangs up and the person goes, hello, 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 and they do that, and they hang up, and they still go, hello. It's just, there's so many reasons why that's impossible and ridiculous. Apart from the fact you can hear, coming out of the phone. So that kind of thing could be a little bit of a pet peeve.
Cars exploding for no reason.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's fun.
Those,
but
in American films, when a car comes off the freeway and they always place those water barrels.
Yes.
First, I don't know why water barrels are on the side of every exit in a freeway. I've been living there 10 years. I've never seen them myself, but they're always
And the
there.
Person that hits them always ends up in like life-threatening condition in hospital anyway. Yes, so you're like, why bother?
Water barrels.
Yeah, it's really not
What's
working.
The use of that? We've been talking about movie deaths, great movie deaths, and Brendan Gleeson's in Bruges. That's
extraordinary. I mentioned that as well. He does something with his eyes in that thing where his eyes go up, red, down, and then just settle.
What was that like to shoot in the middle of Bruges?
Weirdest thing. It was gross.
Prosthetic Gleeson.
You're just going, McDonough, you're just twisted, like literally. Because there's a moment when you step off into it for Brendan, and then you don't be joking about anything anymore because he's work to do and stuff. But before all that, when you arrive on the set and you're having a look, and even Brendan was like, jeez, McDonough, you're a sick man. You're a sick man, which he kind of is. But
he didn't get a doggy bag afterwards.
No, wrap gift. Like you get back your hands and your feet. It was one of the more gnarly things I've seen through the years. It really was. It was just the stump of a body, and they dug a hole in the ground for bread. It was bizarre.
It's one of my favorite films in Bruges, and the dialogue is so brilliant, but it's kind of difficult. It almost defies. It's not a quotable film.
It's kind
of hard to quote some
of
this
stuff. It's very on PC, as well. You've got to be careful of the company you're quoting it in.
Have you been back to Belgium?
I haven't. No, I haven't. But I've met people that have gone there because of the film, kind of, or used the film as a launch point into arriving at the place. And they always go, wow, we loved it. What an amazing place. And I said, how long were you there? And they're like, 3 days. And I said, great, do 8 weeks in the winter and get back to me. That's a strange and magical place. It really actually is. It really is. And the whole film came from Martin finding himself there and him experiencing this fracture in himself, or part of him was going, wow, this is wonderful and quaint and mysterious and I love it, and the other part of him was going, it's boring, there's nothing to do, there's just beer, what the hell. And so he kind of fractured himself and created two characters based on both sides of his abnormal brain.
It turned out nicely. Have you ever shot anywhere that you wanted to go back to?
Morocco.
Vacances. Oh, really?
Morocco, yeah. I haven't been back since Alexander, but it's one place through the years that you know, usually I find when you're on location and you do 2 or 3 months somewhere, you reach a stage where you're ready to either go, I should live here, or I should go home. This is unnatural. And Morocco, I never got to that stage. And I was there for 4.5 months and I just loved it. I just loved it. I was wearing, maybe it was something to do with being able to wear a jalaba, you know, traditional Moroccan dress, literally a dress, you know, and that was kind of, it stopped being kinky really fast and just became the norm. But I loved Morocco.
I read that you haven't seen the final cut of Alexander, of Oliver's fifth attempt or something.
Well, he just did a fifth, I believe, and I've read he sent me some clippings of people that said that it was really good and made sense, and you know, he was rushed majorly. He nearly should have had a year and a half at least to cut it together, to do the effect, all the footage that he'd gotten. Sometimes we were running it in 8-9 cameras. But it was such a huge story, and he'd wanted to make it since he was 18, 19, 20 and studying history in college. So it was too big for him. It was too big for everyone. But yeah, I haven't seen that. I don't know that I need to. Maybe I should, for Oliver, have a look at it. But I'm too... I would have very little perspective on that now.
Distracted by yourself again.
Distracted by myself. Distracted by my hair. I'm still traumatized by, you know, the idea that you can do a film that had a budget of $140 million and have like peroxide hair clips falling out. The take was just, I still never get over it.
Some people shouldn't be blonde.
Well, you know, anytime you give a target that's too easy is, you know, it's let them tackle the themes, let them tackle the expression of certain elements of the story through performance, let them tackle performance. But to give, like, my roots weren't done. It was, I mean, I wish I had my shit together more, because I would have been on top of certain things that would have negated the ease with which people could target the film. But maybe I'll see the fifth version so I can call up Oliver and say to him, "You did it! You cracked it, man!" After all these years. But how obsessed is Oliver, and how wonderful is his drive and his passion for the material that, you know, 10 years later he's in an editing suite, you know, cutting it together.
He's brilliant. He doesn't give up on anything.
No, I love him. He's incredible.
Is there a better version of Miami Vice out there somewhere?
I don't know, man. You'd have to ask Michael Mann about that. You'd have to. Couldn't tell you.
Did it come out like you'd expected it to, in terms of the tone of the thing? It has a real heaviness to it.
It has a heaviness to it. I've spoken before about being underwhelmed by it. I think that it's, if a filmmaker is incredibly technically minded, that it can be easy to get into a rut of style over substance, I think. I think you can fall in love with technology, and I think you can fall in love with framing and composition and camera moves, and sometimes that can, I think then you have both a perfect marriage of both things in the work of Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah,
is, you know, perfect marriage of both technical ability and craft and emotional intellectual understanding of human beings and the possibilities of film.
Yeah. But there's a bit where you go on a date in a speedboat to, like, was, Cuba.
Yeah.
Thomas Anderson doesn't have that.
I had some fun on it.
I really wanted to ask you about The New World, because I've mentioned it twice already, but I do really genuinely love that film. I think it's a real masterpiece, and people probably, you know, it doesn't get as much chat in the Malick canon as it should.
Yeah, no, I know. It's quite down there in the Malick canon. I mean, there's not that many films to choose from, but I know it is. And it's one of the few films that I've been part of that I actually really... that I wasn't a distraction. The film is so beautiful, and the aesthetic of it is so beautiful, and there's such a kind of overwhelming poetry to it, that my presence in it doesn't ruin it for me. I actually love that film as well.
Yeah,
I really do. I really do. I think it's beautiful. I think it's, I want to say it's an important film, but I think from that first, I mean, I think the significance of that first footprint landing on the shoreline, and the death knell for native civilization that very kind of ill-fortuned meeting or coming together of cultures was, you know, I think it's a much more important film than people realize. It's not just like a pretty story about a love between a man and Pocahontas and John Smith. It's really about the founding of a nation and about the dream that still struggles to realize itself every day in America.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree with that. And Chivu Dubitsky, the cinematographer, as well.
Oh, yeah, he's genius.
Shot Gravity and...
Yeah. Matt, he's a genius. Yeah, Chivo is unbelievable. Unbelievable. He's done the last three or four films with Terry, hasn't he?
I think that's correct, although I would need to check.
I can't remember who did To the Wonder. I think it was him.
I think he did as well, yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing quotes from him, To the Wonder. Yeah.
Do you think Malick does screen tests for his cinematographers, just getting them to shoot grass and then and see how it looks?
Yeah, you know? It's a little bit like that. He's genuinely, he sees in, I think, human beings what he sees in nature, and he sees in nature what he sees in human beings, meaning, you know, he sees an emotional significance or relevance between every blade of grass responding to each other and responding to the wind, that he sees in human beings responding to each other and ourselves and our own inner voices, and he sees the same vice versa. I mean, he really does. He looks at one as the extension of another and sees no dividing line. I mean, I would have been doing, on The New World, I remember doing monologue once or just speaking once. I mean, and he had the camera on his shoulder because he operated quite often. He used to love when he'd operate, and all of a sudden he heard a bird behind him and he went, "Oh gosh, is that an osprey?" And he turned the camera around and off he went, and I was just like, that's kind of genius. You know, you don't want to, you wouldn't want to have too fragile an ego, but he's so just, he's so present in the moment, and he's so bewitched by creation, which is how his beautiful film with Brad and Jessica came to being. I mean, he's so bewitched by creation, you know. And I had read a treatment for that years ago, and so beautiful because he doesn't proselytize, but at the same time he does seem to state a belief that he doesn't feel that the belief in God negates the importance of science, or the belief in science negates the possibility that God exists. And so there's something lovely about that it's not stridently, because you know you have a strident religious movement and you have a strident atheistic movement now as well, and I think anything in its stridency is not necessarily a great thing, you know.
Mm. Richard Gere tells this great story about how he was getting some direction from Terry Malick on Days of Heaven, and he said, "What do you want me to do in this scene?" And he just pointed, he said, "Look over there," and he looked at this curtain blowing in the wind. He said, "Do that. That's what I want." And he's like, "Okay."
Did you That's
have
brilliant.
Any, did you have any similar?
No, Terry, no, not really. Just that one. And no, I had a good one with Woody Allen once. And I'm no good at remembering things usually. I just, with Woody Allen, we did a take when I was working with Ewan, and we did a scene in Cassandra's Dream, and did a take. And Woody went, "Got it, let's move on." And I said, because it was literally one take, I said, "Is there... Can I get another one?" And he went, "If you think you can do it better." And I went, "No, you're right." Cool, too much pressure. Move on. Like, "If you think you can do it better."
I've got to ask a couple of other things coming up. We've got New York Winter's Tale early next year, which I think is how it's going in this country. So that sounds like a crazy time, non-specific kind of a story.
I don't know what, I mean, the script was fairly specific, but I saw the trailers now, you wouldn't know what the hell's going on. But I don't know what it is. I haven't seen it yet. I've done some ADR for it, but I haven't seen the film. But it was a beautiful script, incredibly romantic script, and incredibly sweet script. And Akiva's directing debut, and got to work with Jessica, who's wonderful. Did a little bit with Russell. Not much. William Hurt. It was good. It was fun. Even Marie Saint. Yeah, it's kind of...
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm spoiled, man. I had some fun on that as well. So I'll see what the... I don't know what the film is, but I might try and see it in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. And Solace. Is that right?
Solace, yeah. Did a few days on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not the lead, then, I'm guessing.
No. Yeah. No, I did about 4 or 5 days. And I had 3 or 4 scenes, all of them with Tony Hopkins. Sir Anthony, and it was a blast. It was a blast working with him. Man, I had such fun working with him. I mean, send him an email at 3 a.m. and bling, email comes back. Yeah. Talking about sending an email about certain the scene and ideas, and then bling, back he comes. Like, wow,
he's
worse
cog.
Than me.
Did he? Did he sit on set an anecdote? Because we had Tom Hiddleston talking about Thor, and he said just you'd
get
him
great
off.
Stories. Yeah. Great stories, and love sharing them. Absolutely, yeah. And told me a great story about meeting Burton for the first time in Wales when he was a kid, and he was the baker. Tony Hopkins was the baker's son, and Burton was the coal miner's son. And years later, coming full circle, like 15 or 20 years later, I think he was 8 or 9 when he met Burton this one time, called up to his house, and then something like 20 years later when he was in the National Theatre and Burton came backstage and they hadn't met since, and Anthony had no idea if Burton would remember him, and he came in and lit a cigarette, Burton, and he said he didn't even look at me, but he just went, "So the baker's son, huh?"
Wow.
Yeah. And then he went, "Done all right, haven't we?" I kind of got choked up when he told me that because Anthony's Tony's a really emotional fellow. He really is. Like, if you see him, he's very emotional. He's really happy and he's smiling, tears come to him. I had a blast working on Solace. I have no idea what the film is, but I don't know.
And then just a bit of rumour control. You're rumoured for Warcraft.
Don't know what's happening with that. Okay. Yeah, no idea. Well, I read the script and I don't know if they're going ahead with it or what stage it's at, but the script is wonderful. And Duncan Jones is a fine director. He's such a good director. I think he'll kill it with whoever's in it.
Would you be an elf or a dragon? I don't know Warcraft that well.
Me neither. Neither.
People are very passionate about it.
Yes, they are. You have to be careful of that.
Yeah. Veiled warnings from like Elf Master 1 for 3 in the morning. That's yeah, my exactly. agent again.
Exactly.
I think we need to let you go shortly. But just before we do, a couple of things that we call IMDb Bunker. It's kind of, you know, there's the rumour stuff that you get on your IMDb page. And we like to just
done with that. I like the way you've added an unker onto the end of IMDb.
It's clever, right? Yeah, it doesn't really work because there's too many Bs. But anyway, there you go. You're good friends with Jeremy Renner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that's I haven't seen him.
You've probably got other good friends, though.
No. Quite... I haven't seen Jeremy. There was when we were working together, we hung out loads, and then I haven't seen busy as hell. I haven't seen him in the longest time. If I see him now, there'll be a big, sincere man hug between the two of us. But I don't know. Yeah.
Good stuff. Do you think he got enough to do in the Avengers?
Do I think he got enough to do in the Avengers? I'm sure he would have liked to have done more, but it's a pretty big storyline. You're trying to take care of all those characters. I don't know.
That's true.
We were going to ask as well about Bullseye. We were discussing this the other day. We didn't actually come up with a question. We were just like, oh, we should talk about Bullseye.
Go for it.
Well, no, just generally.
We didn't know questions. Bullseye!
The line, you made me miss, was that a tribute to an American Werewolf in London?
When is that an American Werewolf in London?
When the guy's playing darts in the pub.
Oh, yeah. God, remember the Alamo. God, I love that film. God, that's such a good film. Such a tonally genius film. I don't know. No, it wasn't. Yes, it was. That was my idea.
Amazing. Brilliant work.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I got one. You have a few tattoos, I know. Did you ever think about getting a bullseye tattoo?
Never.
There you go.
Okay.
That's it. You heard it here last.
Do you want to do a quick couple more debunkers and then we've got to wrap up?
Oh, do we?
Well, if you have another one or two.
I do have another one, actually. Okay. This one is, I feel a kinship with it because I gave up smoking. You gave up smoking. It says that you wrote a letter to cigarettes.
I did.
To say goodbye.
I did.
Did they write back?
Yes.
What?
Because they never appeared anywhere near me, or they weren't in my fingers. And
yeah.
They wrote back in silence and in action.
So it was okay.
Exactly the kind of response I was looking for. No, I wrote a letter. What I did was I set myself up by making the whole thing is. Because, you know, I have friends that gave up smoking and they smoke cigarettes and they're like, I think I'll give up tomorrow. And they just, you know, they finish their life. But I literally spent the whole day with a box of cigarettes. And each single puff I took, I was like, okay, I'm getting closer to the end, So by the time I came to the last smoke, it was about 11:45 that night before my birthday. And I had written a letter to tobacco thanking it for its presence in my life and for being such a profound part of so many aspects and being there through good moods and bad moods and high times and low times. And then I got a loaded tobacco and I put it on top of the letter. I sprayed it with paraffin oil, put it all in the frying pan, lit it, sent it off in the atmosphere, and I didn't have a smoke for 2 years.
Wow.
But then I started having a couple of sneaky things.
It's so okay.
There might be another letter in the post in the future.
You can text this time, maybe.
Yes.
Anyway.
All right, well, we better wrap it up. Okay. But thank you very much. Save Mr. Banks out this weekend. Everybody go see it.
Cheers. All the best.
But you, Eamon.
What about you? What about you, Colin Farrell? Right, let's move on now to the reviews section. Let's start with Colin Farrell's turn in Saving Mr. Banks, which is a story of how Walt Disney... I've gone really Northern Irish all of a sudden. What's happened? Walt Disney, played by Tom Hanks, persuaded P.L. Travers, played by Emma Thompson, to let him turn her beloved creation, Mary Poppins, into a major motion picture. Thoughts on this one? Is this a dark horse or a frontrunner gate crash in the Oscar race?
I think so. First thing to point out about this movie is that it is a Walt Disney film which stars Walt Disney. So do not, if you've read James L. Roy's L.A. Confidential, you'll know that there is another side to Walt Disney that is probably not explored by Tom Hanks' character in quite that same level of scurrilous, salacious detail. The smoking thing people have made hay with, you know, does he smoke enough? He's a chain smoker in real life, Walt Disney. This film obviously sanitizes the story a little bit, so let's just start with pointing that out. But it is, for all that, really lovely, lovely piece of cinema. And I'll tell you why. Because, first and foremost, I would say Emma Thompson, MVP by miles. She plays P.L. Travers, the writer of Mary Poppins. And it's a story about her creative vision for this thing and how she doesn't want to relinquish it to who she sees as the Americanized kind of popcorn animator. She hates animation. She hates animated animated penguins. So it's a story. It's basically a wrestling match between Tom Hanks as Walt Disney, who's been coveting the rights to make this film for two decades, and P.L. Travers, who doesn't have a lot of money left and her lifestyle is in jeopardy, but still can't bear to relinquish control of this. And the reason for that is the second part of the story, which is the Colin Farrell bit, her father, her childhood in Australia, her upbringing, and how personal it all is to her And the film kind of is two tacks. I thought, and I don't know if you guys agree, that the Disney element works slightly better than the Australian element. I thought Colin Farrell was very good. The cast, Ruth Wilson in the Australian section, were uniformly excellent. But it was played out a little lengthily for me. I don't think it needed quite as much by way of flashbacks.
Yeah, I think they're heavy-handed with the flashbacks. And I mean, the thing is, Emma Thompson gets so much across with so little that you actually need very, very little of the flashbacks to get where she's coming from and get why this matters to her. And I think there's a little bit of a tendency to hammer us with information that we're there already. We've got it. We know where she's coming from.
It's really interesting. We were talking about The Counselor a couple of weeks ago, and there's a film where you are literally in media res and has no interest in telling you what happened before or putting these things into context. And this film is kind of the opposite. It wants to put every single thing into context, give you the backstory of every element, including the reason why she doesn't like pears. That level of minutia is funny and great to an extent, but I think when it's hammered, like you say, is a good word for it, it's a little over the top. But what's great about this film is the quiet moments, I think, the interaction between Emma Thompson and Hanks, and especially the Sherman brothers.
Yeah.
BJ Novak and Jason Schwartzman are both really fantastic. Paul Giamatti is great.
And Bradley Whitford, who's the screenwriter in there with
Bradley
them as
Whitford's
well.
Fantastic. And there's lots of little bits that are, you know, non-dialogue-y. Lots of, you know, it's a very non-verbal acting performance from Emma Thompson. She expresses her disdain for some of the stuff that goes on around her in such a brilliantly English way. And I just enjoyed this film a lot. It reminded me a little bit of Finding Neverland in the sense that it's an origin story for a story that we know really, really well. And it's just a brilliantly told, fun, quite moving tale.
And there's also great comedy in the UK-US culture clash stuff. She's so primly British, and she genuinely finds the Americans' charm offensive, and I think that's just, it's really funny to see that, and see, you know, the more Disney goes over the top in trying to woo her, the more horrified she is by him. And I think it's endlessly funny in that, because neither of them quite gets where the other is coming from, and that sort of, you know, two countries separated by a common language element is just really well played. So
do we get to see her reaction to Dick Van Dyke's accent?
We do get to see her watching the film, yes. Because, spoiler, Walt Disney made Mary Poppins into a movie.
What?
Yeah,
it's true. It's the kind of role that Judi Dench is also very, very good at. She imbues it with enough warmth and humanity to see you through, really, you know, a character that's kind of unpleasant a lot of the time. You know, she's not particularly nice, P.L. Travers, but you do care about her because Emma Thompson makes it so. And I think that's really, really vital. And Tom Hanks, you know, he's good as well. He's good as well as Disney, but it's very much Thompson's film, I would say. And we gave that 4 stars.
4 English stars for Saving Mr. Banks. It may get a crashy Oscar race, a lot of...
I think certainly the acting race. I don't know about the Best Picture. I think it might be nominated. I don't see it winning, but I think it's in with a real shot in the acting race.
And it will make you want to go and fly a kite immediately. But be careful not to do it during lightning.
Indeed. And also stay during the credits to hear the real P.L. Travers on tape, because that's A, hilarious, and B, really, really interesting.
Fantastic. Okay, next up's a long-delayed remake of Stephen King's Carrie, or perhaps more accurately, Brian De Palma's Carrie, starring Chloe Grace Moretz as a young schoolgirl who begins to display telekinetic powers, and Julianne Moore as her religious nutjob of a mother. Kimberly Pierce directs... So what do we make of this? Is this another film to cast on the ever-growing pile of unnecessary horror remakes? Let's go to another girl with telekinetic powers. It's Helen.
Hello. Yeah, I guess. This is a little bit unnecessary, but at the same time, I can see why they did it. I think they have some really interesting ideas and really interesting sort of twists on what De Palma did. And you know, in a couple of cases, they've gone back to Stephen King's book and taken stuff out of that that maybe De Palma didn't. So I think that's interesting. I think... Here, if you know the story, basically, a put-upon girl starts to develop these telekinetic powers just as she's also kind of overcoming bullying at school and beginning to maybe try and find her own feet, independent of her very domineering mother. And it all goes horribly wrong following a prank. That isn't really a spoiler. That's in the trailer. You can't really avoid it. But I think the problem for me was, first of all, they did put all the last act in the trailer, so you know where this is going, and you're kind of building up to it. And there isn't any real sense of, I thought, kind of dread or creeping tension during the early stages of the film. You're just kind
which
of waiting to get...
Palmas.
Which there is, absolutely. Yeah. But I think you're just kind of waiting to get to the good stuff later on. What they do though, is they spend a lot more time, I think, on the relationship between Carrie and Mrs. White and her mother. And Julianne Moore is on, as you'd expect, very, very good form as the mother. And I think, you know, they do a little bit more with that and they try and make more of that relationship, but you still don't quite have this sense that it's all building and building and building towards something momentous. And actually, even then, when it all does go horribly wrong, it feels quite quick. It feels actually not... I mean, in the book, reading the book, you know, she really roams through town and there's just destruction everywhere. And in this one, because I think they're trying to keep your sympathies with Carrie to some extent, there isn't the same trail of destruction to the same extent. Mm. And again, that somewhat takes away from the sense of horror and the sense of terror that you're getting. So I think Kimberly Pierce is essentially not set out to make a horror movie exactly. She set out to make it a sort of a character study of Carrie. And I think in that she kind of succeeds. She has clearly a lot of sympathy for the other school kids. You know, they're not portrayed as plain evil. They're portrayed as, you know, teenagers who make a huge and horrible mistake. And I think that's nice, but it means that the movie is less than some of its parts.
Mm. It's interesting you started talking about the last act being shown in the trailers, because I feel this is a movie... The marketing of this movie has been very, very strange. It's almost marketed for people who almost solely remember the first movie.
Mm.
And I can't see people, you know, 1920, really connecting with this film.
Yeah.
Through the marketing anyway. I mean,
what teenagers nowadays have actually seen the De Palma film or read the book? I mean, the poster said you know her name.
Yeah.
But most people don't.
Yeah, precisely. It's a little bizarre for me. But we gave this one 3 stars.
Yeah. I mean, there's really good stuff in there. It just doesn't quite hang together.
Also out this week is The Best Man Holiday, which is a sequel to The Best Man. The review should be on the website by the time you hear this podcast. We also have Shuné Jolie, which is a French coming-of-age drama which might suffer from being released 1 week after Blue is the Warmest Colour. We gave that, though,
four stars.
Plus, there's Leviathan, not, sadly, a remake of the Peter Weller classic, and that is also 4 stars. Helen, describe that one very, very quickly for
that
the folks at home.
That is an experimental art house documentary about fishing in the North Sea. Completely narrative and dialogue-free, but a stunning collection of images, very immersive.
It says it stars Arthur Smith. Is that the stand-up comedian, Arthur Smith?
No, that is some bloke.
A bloke called Arthur Smith. Who would have credited it? And also we have the US animation Free Birds, which is in no way trying to attempt to cash in on Angry Birds.
Ali, can you describe that in one word?
Turkey.
Turkey, hooray! Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. 2 stars for that film. And that's it for the Empire Podcast. Woo! Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Alexander Payne, director of Nebraska, and of course about Schmidt and Election and The Descendants and all those great films. And also we'll be joined by the star of Kill Your Darlings, the former Boy Who Lived, one Mr. Daniel Radcliffe. And that is a very, very funny interview, let me tell you. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Bye-bye.
It's goodbye from Ali. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to buy a release date porn mag. See you next week.